Have you ever seen a whippoorwill? He sounds too blue to cry. The midnight train is whining low. I'm so lonesome I could cry.
Welcome to Access Utah. This is Sherry Quinn.
And I am Susie Montgomery.
And I am intern Elaine Taylor. I pitched this upcoming story after working in Nine Mile Canyon.
We are driving into the canyon from a rural eastern Utah town with rancher Floyd Cox.
Have you ever seen a robin weep when leaf begins to die? That means he's lost his will to live. I'm so lonesome I could cry.
Nine Mile Canyon is referred to as the world's longest art gallery. Yet its extensive history and beauty are relatively unknown, even to those in its backyard. Located in eastern Utah near the Colorado border, the 40-mile-long narrow canyon has been home to the Fremont and Ute peoples, dating as far back as 2,000 years ago. It is intriguing for many reasons.
The canyons also represent some prime farmland in the midst of a lot of high country. That's always struck me as an interesting juxtaposition. The prime farmland that's surrounded by higher country, and even as those places are connected to other places, they're in a sense constrained and isolated.
That was Steve Sims, professor of anthropology at Utah State University. Within these steep farmlands, the Fremont and later cultures left behind thousands of panels of rock art, many that are still undiscovered. Driving through the canyon, spirals, alien-like figures, hunt panels with dozens of bighorn sheep, buffalo, and lots of abstract shapes are visible as we rambled by. Floyd Cox is a local rancher in his 80s. He was our tour guide and introduced us to what seemed like everyone in his hometown of Roosevelt.
This, to me, is paradise. If you want to go, like, going fishing tonight, or if you want to go out in the desert, or if you want to go and do anything, it's all here. Horses, cattle, anything you want to look at. The peace you find. The people are wonderful out here. They're the best in the West. They're good people. They're the kind of people that make the world turn out here. These people out here do.
Floyd's grandparents were among the first settlers in the area.
Well, it's amazing. When I used to come out here, this is just an old dirt road. We hauled wood out from out here with a team of horses. Because all we had was wood-burning stoves. My grandpa come from Salina and came up here to ranch when they opened up the reservation for farming. 1896, I believe. There was nothing. They had to start from scratch building their houses.
So when you first lived in Nine Mile, no electricity or anything?
No electricity. One little old room shack. No running water. Bath and a number 11 wash tub, yeah. Well, you'd come out here and there'd be nothing. You'd see coyotes, jackrabbits, and cottontails.
But life here has really changed since then. In the past 20 years, the oil industry has grown, bringing jobs and oil workers to the region. Its impact is visible on the landscape.
Boy, this is a nice road. Look at all them pipelines out there. They're all over. Yeah, you go out in the desert now and all you see is oil wells.
What do you think about that?
Well, you can't stop progress. That's a necessity. And it gives everybody jobs. And this place does have a lot of jobs. A lot of jobs out here. A lot of work.
With a step up in the amount of drilling, work for archaeologists, biologists, and paleontologists has grown as well. Nine Mile Canyon sits at the heart of this drilling boom. Currently, Bill Barrett Corporation, a Denver-based oil and gas company, is leasing the land from the BLM, and they are funding road improvements in the canyon as part of its development plan of natural gas reserves. As drilling and digging increase, so does the need for archaeologists. Montgomery Archaeological Consultants, also known as MOAC, is the primary archaeology company in the canyon.
Last year, as a crew member, I got to be part of this exciting time for Nine Mile. From 100-degree summer days to negative 2-degree December afternoons, our crew was on the front line of discovery. And let me tell you, it is phenomenal to be the first person to touch an object that has been buried for hundreds of years and was probably last held by a Fremont Indian. Being there through the different seasons, I can see why so many describe it as one of the most beautiful places in Utah. I have seen rainbows stretch between high canyon walls and too many sunrises and sunsets to count. Even so, it is easy to get sick of a place when you work there. I almost thought I wouldn't be able to enjoy visiting the canyon this time around, but of course, I was wrong.
Floyd, Elaine, and I met her former crew members deep in the canyon at one of the archaeological sites they were excavating along a dirt road.
Paul Shockey is one of the crew members.
Basically the first big earth-moving project in this canyon since, what is it, the 30s, I think. And so all this stuff we're finding is completely unique because it's never been found before. Very interesting. Very cool.
Their job is to monitor current construction to ensure that any archaeological discoveries are recorded. For the field techs that monitor 9 Mile, the job of watching other people dig can be tedious, but the payoff has been tremendous. So far, a number of structures have been uncovered.
They're popping out in weird places.
That is Jody Patterson, the head archaeologist working in 9 Mile Canyon for MOAC. Jody and his crew of half a dozen people are pulling the tarps off one of the small pit houses they are currently excavating. A pit house is a prehistoric living structure hollowed bowl-shaped into the earth, typically with a compacted dirt floor and a hearth.
We've probably excavated just as much, if not more, than everything that has been excavated from 1930 up until 2010. And we're excavating stuff that, you know, it's not visible on the surface. And in a lot of cases, we have really good preservation, like the beans in here, the faunal material, which will give us ideas of what they were, if they were hunting, what they were eating. They're collecting the rock samples right now, wrapping them in foil, and we can send those off to a lab where they can identify the different protein residues that are on them, so that we might be able to tell what they were cooking in the hearth, which we know there's probably going to be quite a bit of corn because we've pulled corn out of here, but they can also identify things like different proteins coming out of different animal fats that get onto the rock and sizzle.
Professor Sims has written extensively about the Fremont and other cultures of the Southwest.
Stable carbon isotopes is an element that is found in human bone that gives you an indication of how much maize, corn, people are eating. And it's long been established that at these large Fremont village sites, the Fremont ate as much maize as their Anasazi relatives in the Four Corners region of the Southwest. Over the lifespan of an individual, often 70-80% of their calories is coming from maize.
There's always been archaeologists coming in here since 1892, but they come in, they spend a year, and they're gone. They write a little paper, and they say that's what it is, and then two or three decades later, somebody else comes in, spends a year, says, no, it's this way. The long-term effort that we've got and thousands of hours of research that's going on here.
Archaeologist Jerry Spangler is executive director of the Colorado Plateau Archaeological Alliance. All of this research is allowing us to finally figure out who the Fremont people were.
We are going to have a much better understanding of how farmers came into the area, when they came into the area. Were they just farmers, or were they also foraging for wild plants? I mean, if you look at the rock art, you get the impression that they were hunters. Lots of bow and arrow scenes and hunting bighorn sheep. Is that supported in the archaeological record? Or is that wishful thinking on their part when they put it up on the cliff faces?
Fremont is a culture, which is a life way and a way of looking at the world, and as all cultures, embodies often considerable variability. And cultures are plastic, and they're also resistant. And so Fremont culture persisted for perhaps 1,000 years, really only about a 300-year peak, and then, like all cultures, it changed. The people didn't disappear. Their descendants are here today. They are the living Native Americans of the Western United States.
Noisy too here.
One of the unfortunate things about archaeology is it tends to be road construction and pipeline construction that determines where we look for archaeology.
Academia cannot provide all the funding for this kind of research, and although the circumstances are not always what everyone would hope for, it does provide an opportunity for us to learn about the Fremont people. I asked Dr. Sims about this dilemma.
When we went to visit Nine Mile, they said that a lot of what they found this year they wouldn't have been able to find without the oil companies coming in and the paving of the road. And I know working at a university, the science is a little different. Can you maybe talk about the pros and cons of archaeology like that versus what you do here?
Well, yeah, you raised the great irony of archaeology. We need to destroy to learn about the past. And ultimately, the only value that the archaeological record has is in the knowledge that it contains. By itself, it's just material objects. But in order to learn about it, we need to dig it and study it, and often destroy individual objects. So the irony is extended when we realize that we are rapidly changing the landscape of America. That very act of resource development, such as natural gas in the Tavaputs area, is at once destructive, and it also offers an opportunity. I personally don't believe in the distinction between academic archaeology and cultural resource management archaeology. Most of my career I've done cultural resource management because that's how you fund your projects. And quality archaeology is quality archaeology, or it isn't.
The upside might be that the unearthing of these prehistoric sites is directly related to the drilling for oil and gas. Uncovering Fremont sites in unexpected areas has begun to extend our knowledge of where the Fremont lived.
So weren't expecting that.
And at the mouth of a site.
When we're digging out in the floodplain itself, either we're not going deep enough or everything's been washed out, flushed out more or less. But once we get up closer to the sides and we're getting into these alluvial fans, we're starting to find stuff. And it's buried relatively deep.
One such site was a 6-meter pit house structure found buried under the canyon road, not far from the site we visited earlier.
This is an exciting pit house. I mean, they all are, but this one's a little bit more aesthetically pleasing to look at. This one was totally buried, no indications of it on the surface whatsoever.
We suspected we had them in here, but we really didn't know for sure. Now we know for sure. And it turned out to be a whole lot more complicated than any of us imagined when we just saw that initial layer of charcoal.
But you have a nice flagstone-lined pit structure. It's just a little bit over 6 meters in diameter. This one had a burnt roof, so when we came down on it, it was basically orange, ashy, with lots of charcoal in it. And then we have some storage pits in here, and they're not all excavated yet, but there's a series of post holes that come around the center of it, which would have been the main supports for the roof. And this was probably also a residential structure, although it's a little bigger than what we've seen out here in the past. There are some known structures, like up at Cottonwood Village, which is a well-known site in the canyon, that does have rock rings that you can see that are about this diameter. But again, not much has been excavated, so we don't really know how atypical this one is. It could be that there's a lot more of them out here, and they're just buried and we haven't seen them. Or it could be a fairly large one, maybe housing an extended family as opposed to a nuclear family type situation. But it's hard to say. We've only got a couple of examples, and this is one of the few that have been excavated.
When we arrived, the crew was wrapping up their excavation of the site.
We found a lot of small points, relatively small compared to what I'm used to finding. And they think that's because they were focusing mainly on small game.
Bone needles, bone awls, ceramics, what look like knife blades, as well as the projectile points, beads, quite a few small beads.
Made out of what material?
There's some gilsonite and shale. And I think there was some that were made out of bone. Yeah, bird bones, because they're hollow. They make really good beads. Burnt corn cobs, those are always fun. It looks literally like a corn cob that burnt.
Yeah. It's been a really cool site. This has been only the second or third site that I've done in 9 Mile, but it's been really exciting. A lot of stuff has been coming up. How many times do trucks go by?
Oh,
so often.
Yeah.
It's hard to hear each other talk when all we can hear is the truck, so we have to wait for a couple minutes for it to pass. And then just stop exactly where we were and pick up at the same word. And that's the only way we can communicate.
And it generally happens all day.
One major concern of all this drilling activity is the clouds of dust kicked up by hordes of semi-trucks driving up and down the canyon, transporting fluids and machinery for oil and gas extraction. Dust has long been a problem in 9 Mile, but it has gotten much worse with this new industrial surge. As we drove out of the canyon, stuck behind semis, we were engulfed in a dusty whiteout.
And one of the things we've done is we've taken historic photographs from the 1930s and some additional photographs from the 1980s/90s and done comparative, where you look at what it looks like today versus 30 years ago versus 80 years ago. And there are some areas where it's clearly road dust. And then there are other areas where it looks exactly the same. It looks dust-covered in the 1930s, too. And so it's what we've learned in doing these studies is don't make overarching statements about, well, the dust is all coming from the road.
Because Bill Barrett Corporation is leasing much of the land for drilling, they're paying to pave the dirt road in order to cut down on the dust in a mutual agreement among state officials and environmental groups.
There has been much debate about the fate of 9 Mile Canyon for several years. Still, the oil and natural gas drilling has led to new findings that will help expand our knowledge of the Fremont culture and how people adapt to and move through their environments.
We cannot deny that the industrial scale activity in this area has led to these new discoveries and is also culprit for the destruction of some of the art that was left behind. But there is a conscientiousness about it. They are spending extra money to reduce the dust pollution, and there are plans to construct visitor exhibits. They have agreed to help preserve this sacred and unique place.
The dialogue now going on in 9 Mile Canyon is a representation of the tension between the demand for natural resources and the value of cultural resource preservation.
More natural gas is being produced in America than at any other time in the past. Natural gas drilling sites are buzzing in farm communities across Utah and the nation. The effects of one site has crept up to the Partons' front porch in Monroe County, Ohio. Young Deb Parton decided to do something about it. SQ Radio presents this vignette, part one of our farmhouse series. Twelve-year-old Deborah Parton lives in a historic farmhouse along Route 260 in Monroe County, bordering the Ohio River in southeastern Ohio. She lives there with her parents, Ruth and Mike, a few horses, chickens, goats, cats, and dogs. They grow berries and other crops on 205 acres of land. Companies are using a technique called horizontal drilling to extract the prized oil and gas trapped deep in the Marcellus shale beds, 6,000 feet below the ground surface. To transport the fracking fluids, they use exposed roadside pipelines and trucks. But the oil and gas industry is poorly regulated, and costly mistakes have been left behind. One right at Deborah's doorstep. She decided to do something about it. She's making films about fracking and distributing them to local communities.
I'm interested in saving my farm and my animals and our family. I don't want our water and everything to get poisoned. The grass, the horses eat getting poisoned in the water and everything. It's about, I think, 5 miles from our house, the drill rig, but we can hear it when they flared off the well. We could hear it.
What does it sound like?
Like, shh. I mean, you could hear it all the way from our house, and the sky was lit up. We could see it from our bathroom window. Now there's more traffic, and these are big trucks zooming by, and you gotta watch, because I ride my horses. The neighbor down the road has horses, and we ride. And they go down the state route, and they're saying there's jobs getting from these wells, but they bring in their own people for the drilling and everything. And then it's just like restaurants and hotels and things that are getting the better jobs. And we live on Route 260. And there was a 10-mile spill of a waste management truck all the way down in front of our house. It's about 10 yards from our front door. And our chickens and dogs and everything go across the road, and it was drill cuttings. And depending on what depth they were at, could be radioactive, lots of different things, poisonous. So nobody ever came and cleaned it up. They said they hired somebody to come out and clean it up.
They just left it?
Mm-hmm. And the next day it rained. So it goes off the sides of the roads and into the grass and everything. So.
What do you think is the most important thing for people to know about it?
That it can contaminate, and the gas companies say we've never contaminated one water well, and it's not true.
Deborah and her parents are urging landowners to at least get baseline and radiation testing of their water before the oil and gas companies start drilling on or near their properties. Sherry Quinn for Access Utah. Stay tuned for Science Questions up next.
Support for Access Utah comes from the Utah Humanities Council, enriching cultural, intellectual, and civic life by providing opportunities for all Utahns to explore life's most engaging questions and the wonders of the human experience.
Are you deadline-driven, most productive as zero-hour approaches? Well, what about the ultimate end, the true end of the time frame? Deadline indeed. How does knowing that you're going to die affect your life? I'm Jim Fleming. Next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge, we're minding mortality. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday mornings at 9 on Utah Public Radio. Support for Science Questions is provided by Apogee Instruments of Cache Valley, creating innovative sensors for measuring climate change, sustainable food production, and renewable energy. More information is at apogeeinstruments.com.
He who controls the spice controls the universe.
Welcome to Science Questions. I am Sherry Quinn.
And I am Susie Montgomery.
That is author Temple Grandin, referring to the science fiction novel Dune by Frank Herbert, later turned into a Hollywood movie. The story is set far into the future and takes place on the desert planet Arrakis, the only source of the most valuable spice or substance in the universe, melange.
The planet is Arrakis, also known as Dune.
You are about to enter a world where the unexpected.
Many dangers exist on Arrakis.
The unknown.
An incredible secret has been kept on this planet.
And the unbelievable meet.
According to Grandin, this tale about the battle over Melange and the direction it takes human civilization mirrors reality. And now the spice is natural gas. U.S. House lawmakers from the Subcommittee on Energy and Mineral Resources met in Steubenville, Ohio in March for a hearing on natural gas. Congressman Doug Lamborn has dollar signs in his eyes.
The natural gas industry has the potential to bring in billions of dollars of federal revenue, bring energy to our national economy, create good-paying jobs for thousands of Americans, and most importantly, greatly contribute to the economies of the towns and cities that benefit from this development.
And the areas being targeted for this unconventional natural gas extraction sit atop a unique geographical feature.
The United States is blessed with some of the richest and largest natural gas shale fields in the world. The Marcellus Shale, Barnett Shale, the Bakken Formation are all previously unproductive areas that have just recently become extraordinarily productive gas and oil fields because of hydraulic fracturing.
Natural gas from shale provided only 1% of the nation's gas supplies in 2000. Now it is 25%, the beginning of a new era. The increase is due to hydraulic fracturing, known as fracking. It involves drilling deep, about 6,000 feet below the ground surface, and then horizontally in any direction, causing a web of fractures that releases millions of years-old reserves of natural gas, shaking up this till-now untouched antediluvian underground and siphoning out its contents is releasing deep concerns.
Calling 911, where's your emergency?
Hey, my house just shook really bad.
Yes, it probably was an earthquake.
You can hear it coming towards you kind of like you would a train. You feel it under your feet.
It shook our whole house about off the foundation, ma'am.
Good evening. Since September, there have been 843 earthquakes in the Greenbrier-Guy Swarm. This fault was previously...
Today on the program, we travel to two of the nation's fracking hubs, southeastern Ohio and the Uinta Basin area of eastern Utah, where oil and gas companies are breaking into deep pockets of the earth, forcing us to ask, is the easy money and fuel worth all the risk? Risks like polluted drinking water, toxic air, dangerous chemical spills, loud obnoxious noises, earthquakes, heavy traffic, sick animals, loss of habitat, and loss of prime farmland. Our first stop in this story is Ohio. Proudly surrounded by his pack of black labs, Mick Luber, known as the Renaissance Farmer, answers our question with a resounding no. Fracking is definitely not worth it.
This is Katie 2. There was a Katie 1 and a big Katie before them. This is Lucinda, and that's Sylvester. They're the rodent control. They're working dogs, and they do a good job.
Then there's Nancy Sinatra, the cat with the white boots, and Goldie, named after the movie star.
The chickens are the manure source for everything. We do compost. We do about 3 tons of compost a year. And that's the fertility for these beds.
Mick is a certified organic farmer. His 61-acre farm in Cadiz, Ohio, sits close to the border of West Virginia, nestled in a small, lush green valley surrounded by rolling forested hills. He specializes in garlic and lettuce, and grows fruit, herbs, mushrooms, flowers, raises chickens for eggs, and has row upon row of lettuce in a prism of red and yellow shades. All kinds of beans.
Green, yellow, striped, speckled beans. I cook a lot, so I grow what I like to cook, and it makes it really nice for customers at the markets because they can find out little tips about what they can eat for dinner the next night. I grow 12 kinds of onions. It's just nice, all the varieties. It changes every day. It's so creative. I have lettuce patches like that run as long as this bed here, which is about 200 feet long. And there's 30 different kinds of lettuce in it, and it's like a painting. It's just beautiful.
Mick established his farm in 1989, one of the longest continually certified organic farms in the state of Ohio. The inspiration for organic farming started when he was a young boy in Chicago, frequenting the local supermarket with his father.
I used to go to a Jewel Tea store to get fresh produce. Produce manager's hands were always cracked and bleeding. I became friends with him, asked him about his hands. He says, all the chemicals on this produce, I can't get my hands to heal. Doctors tell me I should be wearing gloves. But it wouldn't be good for customers to see somebody wearing gloves. This is in 1968 or 69.
But this move to organic wasn't a lasting escape. Mick fears that the pesticides that were cracking hands in the 60s are replaced by fracking chemicals, toxifying his air, water, and his soil too. Just like many rural towns across the nation, his community is surrounded by fracking sites. And in fact, his neighbor just up the hill from him leased his land to Chesapeake Oil and Gas, who last year installed a drip tank about the size of a one-car garage on his property to collect moisture from fracking wells.
We got into Mick's car and drove to it with artist Zach Pontius and farmer Sherry Becker-Gorby. All of them are from communities that live atop the shale.
And this is my neighbor that caved. He came over and talked to me one day. I was turning the compost pile, and he was all against it and everything like that. And then I called my neighbor, and I found out that he had caved. Just to the intimidation, he didn't really have to let him in there. A neighbor up on the hill let him put in the drip. If they hadn't talked like they were against it, I don't think I would have got as mad. And here's the tank. You can pull over there on that side of the road. You can see the drip. And we can get out. And they might have a camera here, so you can wave. Do you see that door up there that's open? According to things that I've seen, if you had an infrared thing, you could see stuff coming out of there. And that's volatile chemicals that can float down that valley, and we're going to have to breathe it.
Roughly half the fracking fluid remains in the ground. The rest of it, 1 million to 4 million gallons, comes up out of the well and is toxic industrial waste. But is it being disposed of safely? That is a major concern currently under scrutiny by concerned citizens, scientists, and a myriad of organizations, including the EPA.
John Stoltz. I'm a professor of biology in the Department of Biological Sciences at Duquesne University. Unfortunately, once you contaminate an aquifer, it takes centuries. And that's something I learned from the DOE. Seeing all the work that's been done to remediate Superfund sites, realizing how difficult it is to clean something up once it's contaminated. In some cases, they've removed all the surface contamination and replaced it with pristine topsoil. And yet, contaminants continue to leach out of the subsurface, and they're beside themselves to try and do something about it.
Back at the farm, Mick sits in the shadow of a giant holding tank, casting a constant reminder, even an omen, of what is about to be unleashed.
At nights, the airflow comes over top of the hill. If there's chemicals venting out of that tank, it's going to come down that valley and run right past this house. Nice blue tank. Isn't that nice? Just like the sky. It's a rented tank, so somebody else is responsible for taking it out and putting it in. And I'm afraid whoever does it is going to spill stuff. That also comes down and runs through this valley. The stream here floods a couple times a year in a wet year. Last year, ran over these fields two times. I'll lose my certification if that happens.
The actual drilling site where they're extracting the gas is located about half a mile up the road from the blue tank. It looked like a small industrial village equipped with large cement enclosures, spotlights, semi-trucks, and networks of pipe that are lining the hillsides like arteries and veins, transferring the fracking fluids and gas to and fro. A big operation.
And how concerned are you about your land and the future of it?
Well, it's scary. My water here has already been ruined by coal mines. There's iron oxide in the water, and I don't need more chemicals in order to make me grow.
Hydrofracking is booming since Halliburton's horizontal drilling technology allowed its arms to reach a mile radius in any direction, pumping water and binding chemicals into the deep pockets of the Marcellus Shale. The pockets of the oil and gas companies are comparatively deep. We heard this along the way. Horizontal drilling makes for vertical profits. And we're talking multi-billion dollar vertical profits, stepping on shoulders to fatten the stack.
We've lost so much in this area. We've been a national sacrifice area for the steel and coal industry. And here comes another. There's not a big population in this area, so it's easy to bring a little bit of cash in. By people's loyalty.
Most of us know what it feels like not to get along with a neighbor. And really, no kind of fence can stop this one. In a culture where each keeps to his or her own and choices free, fracking is changing this culture. Mick's neighbor made an independent choice for his own reasons, but this choice is now governing Mick's organic future.
This is like the split the neighborhood thing. I have not sold my gas. I don't plan on selling my gas. They did sell their gas. I've known these people for 28 years.
I've done their gardens for them. The guy that moved up on the hill, I took my tractor, tilled his garden when he first moved in so he could have a garden. I have not spoken to them since it happened. It's not easy.
Right.
To lose your neighbors to something. And those gas people will leave here, and they'll still be my neighbors. And there's this animosity now. I'm sure that they would forgive me for not talking to them. And those gas people will leave here, and they'll still be my neighbors. And there's this animosity now. I'm sure that they would forgive me for not talking to them. And the industrial process that they're talking about with this fracking, I mean, it's like putting a steel mill or a coal dock on the top of these hills. And to think that something like that is going to happen here again, it makes me glad that I'm old and that I don't have to watch it all over again and drink the water and go through all that stuff. When you go into the stores around here now, most people come in and they're buying bottled water. And I'm afraid with this, the advent of this gas and oil shale stuff, that they're going to have to be buying water to bathe in, not just water to drink.
For these reasons, Luber won't lease. He won't even budge. And he certainly isn't seduced by the young, well-dressed, handsome men that come by the house.
They always send in these cute little boys with suits and ties and a little briefcase, look like they got out of college, to tell you that everything was going to be all right if they were doing some sort of project in your area. And that's exactly what these people look like. They look like somebody you would trust. But when you really get down to the nitty-gritty, you can't trust anybody. They call all the time. They offered me $350,000 the other day for 60 acres. So that's $5,500 or something like that, an acre. Yeah. No, that's just a sign, an agreement so that they can. And it's 15.5% royalty on if they do drill. But I'm not signing.
You can't help but wonder, if everyone was selling around you, wouldn't you cave too?
How do you stop these guys? It's just, it's like impossible. If you sold your place, where aren't they going to be next?
And how long do you expect this to last?
Well, they're talking about this being around forever. I mean, if you look out west at the sites that they have out west, it doesn't look like they're stopping. And they're going to frack these things two or three times. If the normal life expectancy is 3 years on these wells, and then they frack them again and frack them again and frack them again, so they could be here for 25, 30 years. And who knows how long.
What's happening in McLuber's moist, green environment is also happening in a totally different ecosystem, nearly 2,000 miles away, in the high desert of northeastern Utah. It is part of the Colorado Plateau, and it's called the Uinta Basin. Here, the summers are hot and dry, and the winters hover at 0 degrees. Driving into the area's famous prehistoric rock art gallery, 9 Mile Canyon, the surrounding views are vast fields of beige-colored granite, speckled with light green sagebrush, bordered with striking mustard and rusty red-colored cliffs, topped with cedar and juniper trees. Below, the river valley is filled with aspen, scrub oak, and pine. We are with well-known and respected local Floyd Cox. He comes from a long line of ranchers in the region. It used to be strictly cowboy and Indian country. But since the 1980s, he has seen the oil companies move in, and now ranchers and drill sites sit side by side.
Boy, this is a nice road. Look at all them pipelines out there. They're all over. Yeah, you go out in the desert now and all you see is oil wells.
What do you think about that?
Well, you can't stop progress. That's a necessity. and it gives everybody jobs. And we this place does have a lot of jobs out here, a lot of work.
He has seen the counties of Carbon, Duchesne, and Uinta boom and bust since the 1940s due to fluctuations in the oil and gas industry. Right now, it is flourishing with jobs and growth alongside the ranchers and farmers. Conventional oil fields in the Uinta Basin provide 67% of Utah's total crude oil production, while the basin's unconventional natural gas fields provide 71% of Utah's total natural gas, a whopping 175% increase in the last 10 years. Veteran oil and gas industry worker and farmer, Steve, who is going by that name to remain anonymous, knows both industries inside and out. He says that comes with growing up in the Uinta Basin. Work is oil-related, and on your days off, you farm. It's just a different world, he says. Steve and his cousin and I recently shared a cup of coffee and some fracking conversation at his home he shares with his wife, two boys, three dogs, two cats, and a team of horses in his fields out back.
What it comes down to is keeping up with the Joneses or staying ahead of the Joneses. Somebody's worried somebody else is going to get somebody something that nobody else got. It's just like, no.
In the nearby town of Mighton, Steve says one of his fellow farmers has learned to take advantage of his neighbor's mistakes.
Every twice in a while, they dump a crude truck right there. Off the road, tip it over, make
You're
a mess.
Kidding.
You know what he does? He runs out there with his tractor and spreads that oil around. All over his pasture.
Was that good for it?
That's one of the best fertilizers because it's all natural.
At times, when utilized properly and safely, farmers can benefit from the oil spills. But that is the exception. Steve says agriculture is the biggest and fastest depleting resource on the planet.
And the biggest reason is big corporations, and especially this area, is the oil and gas industry. Because they will go in and take that strip of road out of your field, and they will put that location right in the center of it. And let's say that they take 7 acres, and if it's good farmable ground, you're looking at 3 mother cows. Could live on that. If it's hay, and let's say it's a good hay field, and it's producing a whole bunch, well, on them 7 acres, let's say that in the end, you're getting really, really good, decent ground, 3 ton to the acre. Okay, well, ton of hay is how much?
Good alfalfa hay is selling for $200 to $260 a ton based on the current market. And it goes up every year. The same with beef. Right now, Steve says he can get $1,300 a pair. That's a mother cow and her calf. It begs the question, what is more valuable, hay for feed or natural gas for cheap fuel? To a farmer, hay can be worth more than gold. But if the farmer only owns the surface rights to his or her property and not the mineral rights, the oil and gas companies can move in and reap the resource, leaving the farmer out of luck.
The law says the minerals are there, and they can go get them. Human nature is also leans toward the side of always a quick buck, not what's right or wrong.
Although the companies usually offer compensation, it is never enough, even when farmers own the mineral rights and decide to lease anyway.
We're going to put this location here, and all these empty promises, this is going to be a good, beautiful thing, and we're going to pay you $9,000 for nothing, for tearing up your ground, one-time shot deal. We're going to use 1/8 of an acre of your ground right on the corner, cutting into that sagebrush right there, but then we're going to directional drill that out to the middle of your field. Mm-hmm. So you're going to have to farm around this 1/8 of an acre corner right here, which probably your sprinklers and stuff don't hit anyway. That's the most justifiable we can do. We'll give you $9,000 for that 1/8 of an acre. We'll give you $9,000 for the whole mess we're going to put out in the middle of your field.
That's it, really? I mean,
that's what it boils down to. It is that freaking simple.
The Ute Indian Reservation in the Uinta Basin is the second largest reservation in the United States, and they're leasing chunks of their land to the oil and gas companies for more money than what the farmers outside of the reservation are getting. The long-term economic impact to the farmers and the Utes will add up. As prices of hay and beef rise each year, the cumulative effect of the loss of land will catch up to them years later in monetary losses. And the oil and gas companies do not account for that. They also don't take responsibility or liability for any leftover messes. Instead, the landowner is left to deal with them.
Leaves the mineral rights holders, leaves them responsible also for spills, contamination, blah, blah, blah. And the oil company sitting back there raking in big bucks and leaving the liability to so-and-so. And for as long as they want to produce that location, produce that well, produce that lease, they're probably going to take care of business and step up to bat. But in them contracts, it does not say that they cannot walk away and leave you totally liable. It says just the other way. If it gets bad enough, we're going to throw our hands in the air. You're going to be responsible for whatever mess we leave. We're out of here. So that's why I say, who's right and who's wrong?
Yeah.
The guy says, come in, come on, give me that $9,000 and put all that liability on me. When in return, it should be no. And that's the thing, you cannot deny them.
Why?
But the law says you
can't. Just because the law, yeah.
But you can say, well, all right. You want to build this location? Sooner or later, that well's going to, it's going to peter off and not be justifiable for anybody to do anything with it. You can't do away with petroleum energy. We're too dependent on it. There's some good guys, and a lot of them just have no idea what they're doing, and they're too afraid to get fired to tell their boss, no, this is morally wrong. We ain't going to drive out in the middle of his field and say, no, they should approach with a plan and go do environmental impact reports and cost reports and just little spreadsheets that says, you know, approach the farmer and say, you know, we would like to poke the hole right out in the middle of your 80 acres. But we're going to destroy about 7 acres getting there because of our road, because of where we're going to put the location. You're going to have to farm around it. Most of these people are their neighbors, or one of their nephews works for that oil company. This is a clannish bunch of people up here.
To really keep track of their impact on the land, Steve sees the need for companies to self-regulate much more so than they did in the past.
Everything that's going to be done on these, you can look up in archive after archive. There's no soil samples from 1980. What has the ground done? What did it look like? Unless you know somebody with pictures, it's all word of mouth. The law is what the law is, whatever. They should have to do their freaking environmental impact reports. They should, start to finish.
One of the side effects of fast, poorly regulated oil and gas drilling activity is what's referred to as poison gas.
They inject water into the formation, pushes the oil out toward the oil wells. Some of the water comes up too, yes. But now that water's contaminated because oil and water don't mix.
The result is H2S, hydrogen sulfide, a toxic gas that smells like rotten eggs.
They say like the dust you see in the window pane when the sun's shining through, that'll be like one part per every 10 million. And you can see it. If you took a whiff of, I believe it's 10 parts per million of hydrogen sulfide, you're dead. Like that fast. Here lies another problem, like with what Newfield and a lot of other outfits, I'm just not picking on them, do. They sit and they inject into the ground. Have you ever put a bucket of water outside? It goes stagnant, right? It starts to stink. That's H2S. That's decaying matter. There's little bugs that's in the water, little bugs that float across the air, that are in the air anyway, get into the water, and it sits there and it starts to decay. And even if you put it in a bowl or a cup or a jug and you cap it and you set it outside, you're going to want to drink it in a month.
The oil and gas companies are using filters, cloth ones developed in the 1970s.
They're filtering out chunks of slag and just anything that is going to screw with their wellbore. They're not filtering out these little microscopic organisms and stuff in the water. You're agitating it again when it comes back to surface, gets a breath of fresh air. You suck it into a water truck, you agitate it in the water truck, so now you got it really stirred up and you take it somewhere and you inject it again. Look up the Jonah Field over in Wyoming. Look up the field that's right there, this side of Echo. They've not been doing business according to, look what we're doing.
Those of us living near oil refineries, oil and gas fields, and factory farms' huge sewage lagoons risk long-term exposure to H2S, causing permanent nervous and respiratory system damage, and in some cases, death. It has not affected the Uinta Basin too much yet, but the problem there is starting to get worse. Although hydrogen sulfide sources are supposed to report their emissions to the EPA, the agency has allowed these polluters to avoid reporting their pollution for nearly two decades. The farmers in southeastern Ohio and in northeastern Utah are all deeply rooted to the land, each of them going back generations as either steelworkers, coal miners, oil workers, or farmers and ranchers. Talking to Mick Luber is holding up a mirror to what is happening out west. Only the background scenery is different.
Everybody wants to be a millionaire. But I'm a millionaire in soil and worms and that kind of stuff.
The drip tank was recently removed from his neighbor's property, but Mick said there was some spillage, and another one is going in nearby. The pipeline right-of-way is still happening heavily in his area, and Mick Luber is still constantly approached, but he always refuses.
Science Questions is produced by Sherry Quinn, Zizi Montgomery, and intern Elaine Taylor. Thank you for listening.